To see everybody, thank you very much to the band. Some jamming. I hope you've had a great weekend so far. It is great to see everybody. I feel very excited about what we're going to be talking about today. If you have been with us over the last couple of weeks, we've really been busy with a series on the great women of the Bible. And my hope is, if you've been with us, my hope is that you feel convinced that God has used women in powerful ways to literally shape the course of history. Throughout the beginning, since the creation, really to our day today. And God continues to do that in amazing and amazing ways. And my hope this morning for us is that as we look at sort of a great woman in the Bible, that you'll feel again moved and inspired by her life. And that you would be able to walk away with renewed faith and renewed inspiration to be able to emulate and imitate her in a great way. Yeah, the great woman that we're going to be talking about this morning has always grabbed hold of my attention. When I've read her story, when I've studied her out, when I've heard her story being spoken about others, she's always grabbed my attention in my heart. And as I've been committed to studying her deeper, my appreciation for her has just grown and grown and just gotten deeper and deeper as the time has gone by. She truly is a great woman. You know, she is an Old Testament character, and her name is actually mentioned a number of times in the New Testament in quite prominent places. She is the only woman mentioned in the Great Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. Now, there is another woman mentioned, Sarah, but Sarah is really mentioned in connection with her husband. She is the only one mentioned among names like Abraham, Moses, Noah, David. Some of the greatest men in the Old Testament is in that list, and her name appears among that list. She's a great, great woman of faith. And also, later on, when she was eventually adopted into the Israelite community, she married a man named Salmon. Now, if you're a sushi lover, this is my justification that you must have liked sushi, but the guy's name was Salmon. And they had a son together called Boaz, who eventually got married to Ruth. So really, this woman was the mother-in-law of Ruth herself. She was the great-grandmother of King David. And as it says in Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, she ultimately, in human terms, was in the line of Jesus Christ himself. She truly is a great woman. You know, with all of that said, though, I believe that she is, again, one of those unlikely great women. And I think she would have been incredibly surprised to even read that the New Testament writers would write about her in a respectful way. And I think she would never have dreamt in all of her life that a young South African minister would get up and speak about her in a series on great women of the Bible. I believe that she is a very unlikely candidate, but yet incredibly great. You know, my prayer is that her story will inspire you. And the story that we're going to be talking about this morning is a story about the God that you and I serve and about a woman named Rahab. Please turn your Bibles to Joshua chapter 2. Rahab. Now, just before we jump into Joshua chapter 2 here, just to bring you up to speed with a little bit of context here, biblical context of where we are right now in the story. After Joseph died, the Israelites under that Pharaoh was enslaved and was really made to do some hard labor. And they were so fruitful and multiplied so much, Egypt was really the known world power at the time, that the Pharaoh got a little bit afraid that the Jews are going to take over sort of his country and his place. So they promulgated a law that any one of the Jewish kids below 2 years old, every boy must be put to death. And in this environment, sort of the Israelites started crying out to God for deliverance, crying out, God, please help us. Get us away from these slave drivers. Give us our own country. And God saved and raised up a man named Moses that really led out the Israelites in a powerful, powerful way out of Egypt. They literally passed through the Red Sea on dry ground. And after God took them to Mount Sinai, giving them the law, God started taking them towards what we know as the promised land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. That was really where they were going towards. And then Moses sent out 10 spies. We know the story very well. 8 of the spies came back and gave an unfaithful, a faithless report about the country. They said, absolutely, it flows with milk and honey. It's an amazing place, but we can't go there. There's giants. There's fortified cities. We can't do it. And then 2 of the spies that came back, Joshua and Caleb, gave a faithful report and said, no, we can. We need to trust God. We need to go. God will help us to be successful. Unfortunately, the community listened to the 8 spies that was faithless, and they rebelled and said, we're not going into the land of Canaan. And because of that, God punished them and said, all right, you know, we're going to spend 40 years in the desert, and I'm going to teach you and I'm going to train you to trust me. And I will rain down manna and I will rain down quail every day just enough so that you guys can get the point that I'm trustworthy. And after that generation passed out, a new leader under the leadership of Joshua and this new generation of Israelites were now ready to enter the promised land of Canaan. So where we pick up in the story in the book of Joshua right here is they are literally on the brink of entering this promised land that God said he will give to them. Joshua chapter 1, God promises Joshua and said he will be with them as he was with Moses and that he will be successful. He just has to trust God and be filled with faith. So let's jump in here in chapter 2 as they start off on this campaign to enter the promised land, and we'll meet Rahab in a city named Jericho. Verse 1 says, then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent 2 spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. Yeah, it says there that Joshua secretly sent out 2 spies to check out the promised land. They crossed over the Jordan River. They got to the city of Jericho, and it said that they entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab. Now, a couple of things here about Jericho, and the map should be up on the screen. The city of Jericho, there's a modern-day city of Jericho and really an ancient city of Jericho. The city of Jericho is situated, it's sort of marked in red there, very close to the Jordan River, just to the north of the Dead Sea. Actually, a couple of years ago, I was standing on Mount Nebo where God took Moses onto Mount Nebo, and he would look over the promised land, and God would say, whatever you see, I will give you. And in actual fact, from Mount Nebo, if you look towards Jericho, it's about 25 kilometers. But that's really where the city of Jericho was situated right here. And the site where the ancient city of Jericho was has become a very important archaeological site. It's actually the second most excavated city in the whole of Israel. And it's been very important for us through centuries of digging up the ancient site of Jericho. We have learned so much about that city. And in the next slide, we'll sort of, that's kind of an aerial view of this area of the ancient city of Jericho. You can see it's about, they estimated it's about 9 acres in land. I don't know what that is in square meters, but that's sort of the ancient site with a lot of diggings that you can see right there. So that's kind of where Jericho was. And this is some of the things that they've learned. Number one is Jericho was one of the many city-states in Canaan. Each one of these cities were ruled by a separate king. So it was almost like the old Greeks as well, that they would have these fortified cities and every one of them would have this individual king and that would rule over that city and the inhabitants of that city. They also realized, which you can sort of see here, is that Jericho was really situated, the upper side of Jericho was really situated on a little bit of a mound, on like a hill. And it was incredibly well fortified. Here's sort of a depiction of that, what they found in the excavations. Is that at the bottom, you have a retaining wall made of stone. Now, it's sort of measured in feet there. It's about 12 to 15 feet, which is about 4 to 5 meters high. On top of the retaining wall, right at the bottom, is built a mud brick wall that's about 20 to 26 feet high. So again, you're talking about probably about 8 meters high is built on that. Then you have this embankment, this slope sloping up towards the upper part of Jericho. And then towards the upper part, there's kind of another, almost an upper wall that's the same height as the mud brick wall at the bottom. So incredibly fortified. It would almost be like, I don't know if you've seen Lord of the Rings with Helm's Deep. It's almost like that, where you stand there and you go, this thing, we cannot get in here, man. This is a fortified city. But that's what the Israelites and those little men walking sort of at the bottom there, that kind of depicts sort of the outside perimeter of the city of Jericho. So, and kind of had this upper wall and lower wall that really ran parallel towards one another, and that embankment separating the two. Now, within the upper wall area, so at the top, was an area of about 6 acres. Like I just said, the whole area spanned about 9 acres. And based on archaeologists' sort of rule of thumb, they estimated that the upper part of Jericho would probably have about 1,200 inhabitants. Now, what they found subsequently with a series of diggings as well is not only were the inhabitants at the upper part, but people actually used to live on that embankment. And that's where they believed Rahab's house to be, sort of towards this lower wall right here, almost a depiction. If you look towards that, you'll see sort of a pile of bricks on the corner here, and towards the left, in the left-hand corner, you can almost see what would be depicted by an illustrator as Rahab's house. So her house was situated in this embankment right against the lower wall with her window sort of overlooking kind of the outside perimeter of Jericho. So just to give you kind of a little bit of a mental picture of what we're talking about here in Jericho and Rahab's house. Now, how the spies met Rahab and why they chose to stay at her house, we don't know. The passage doesn't make it clear. We can only speculate. But I want to tell you this. As we go through this story, it will become incredibly clear that God was at work. That God had a greater purpose than what Moses, or what Joshua even imagined. God had a greater purpose than just the spies collecting information about sort of the destruction of Jericho. God was at work. And you'll see how that unfolds. But what do we know about Rahab? We definitely know that she was a prostitute. Now, I want to clear something up here. You'll see if you have an NIV translation, there's a little bit of a small letter next to prostitute, a little A, and then there's a footnote that says, possibly an innkeeper. All right. Now, what they would do is... Well, let me say this. The Wiersbe, which is a Bible commentator, confirms that the Hebrew word translated for prostitute can also mean a keeper of an inn. That would make sense. So that would almost make Rahab a little bit of like a bed and breakfast manageress, like a little lodge on this embankment in Jericho. And that would make a lot of sense for the spies to go there, right? Now, if the Old Testament text was the only thing that we had to go by, We could probably concede that maybe she was either a prostitute or an innkeeper. But in the New Testament, when the New Testament writers write about Rahab in Hebrews chapter 11 and also in James chapter 2, they use the Greek word that definitely means prostitute. So we can be pretty sure that she was not an innkeeper, and it would be right for the translators to put it in here, but she was definitely not an innkeeper. She was a prostitute. That was her profession. That was the life that she lived. Now, there were two types of prostitution that was very familiar in the Old Testament times. One was secular, so it was almost like a business where I would exchange sex for money. And then the other one was worship prostitution. So with pagan idolatry and pagan worship, what would happen is there would be male and female prostitutes, which the worshippers would go to these temples, have sex with these prostitutes because they believed when they do that these deities, these gods, would make their lands fertile and would bless them. So those are kind of the two types. Now, again, we don't know which type of prostitution Rahab practiced or even why she chose this. And I don't know, but it could even have been acceptable in her neighborhood because she was part of a pagan nation. It might have been okay for them. But what we definitely know is that her lifestyle and her immorality and purity and promiscuity was detestable to God. You know, in Hebrews chapter 23, verse 17 and 18, it says, "There must never be a sacred prostitute among the young women of Israel, nor a sacred male prostitute among the young men of Israel. You must never bring the pay of a female prostitute or the wages of a male prostitute into the temple of the Lord your God in fulfillment of any vow, for both of these are abhorrent to the Lord your God." So whichever one she practiced and whatever you know, whatever her situation was, God was not happy with the lifestyle that she lived. Now, I don't know about you, but my guess is probably many of us would not be able to relate to the lifestyle that she lived. But I believe all of us would be able to relate with what it means to be stuck in a lifestyle of sin. We can all relate to that. We have all been there. We've all lived a life where we've been separate from God, without hope. We've all lived a life where our life was filled with shame and guilt and, you know, and loneliness and isolation. And that's probably the life that Rahab experienced on a daily basis. Now, we don't know whether she was married at this point in time in the passage right here. But my guess is they never speak about her husband in Joshua chapter 2. But my guess is if you think about her profession, she is probably a single woman. And as we'll see later on, both of her parents lived with her in Jericho and was still alive at this time. And she also had brothers and sisters. So her whole family lived with her in the city of Jericho. Let's carry on here in verse 2. That hopefully gives you a little bit of a mental picture of her life and the city that she lived in. Verse 2 says, the king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent the message to Rahab, bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. You know, somehow the spies didn't go unnoticed or undetected. And the word of this reaches the king of Jericho. And he sends his delegation of men to Rahab's house, knocking on the door saying, hey, look, we know that those spies came to your place. We know that they are there. Now hand them over. Now put yourself in the shoes of Rahab here for a moment. Think about what that must have been like. We hear a knock on the door. And there's the king's men standing outside, demanding that she hands over the spies. Imagine what must have been some of the temptations that she might have felt. The fear and the anxiety. But yet we can sort of, you almost sense this is again one of those defining moments in her life, that the choices that she makes at this point in time might radically alter the rest of her life. Kind of get the sense of that. She was faced with a choice. Let's see what she did in verse 4. It says, but the woman had taken the men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. Now, I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. You know, Rahab made a decision to protect the Israelite spies and to disobey her earthly king. And it describes that before the men knocked on the door, she quickly went up onto the roof, hid these Israelite spies, and when the men came, she said, yeah, the men were here, but they've actually left. They've gone out. And she sent the king's men off on a wild goose chase, protecting the Israelite spies. Now, why would she do that? Why run the risk? I mean, and I believe had the king discovered her deception, I can only imagine how you would have killed her. You would have slain her as a traitor. I mean, here his city was in danger because of these Israelite spies. Why take the risk for men that you have never known in your whole life? That is not even inside of Jericho. Why do that? Have a look in verse 8. It says, before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and the great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. Yeah, the thing that enabled Rahab to trump her fear of man and to go against the wrath of the king And to take such a risk was her incredible faith. It was her amazing faith. And she describes to these men, she has heard of the God of the Israelites. She says to them, we have heard what you guys did to our neighboring kings, the Amorite kings of Sihon and Og. We have heard the stories that you completely obliterated them. We have heard that God gave you victory over them. You know, I've heard the story when you guys came up out of Egypt, how God marched you through the Red Sea on dry ground. Now, fascinating thing about that is that happened 40 years earlier. And yet she knows it. She has heard the story of this God of the Israelites. And maybe it was her parents. Maybe it was her family that sat down at mealtimes and they would recount these stories, even in Jericho, about how powerful this God was, how wonderful this God was. And she heard these different stories and she believed. She believed in the God of the Israelites. Now, firstly, she believed that God will deliver on his promises to Israel. You see that in verse 9. It says there, I know that the Lord has given this land to you and that a great fear of you has fallen on us. You know, she says, I know it. Absolutely. God promised that you'll have this land, you know, to Moses and the Israelites and to you, Joshua. I know God will give you this land. I believe the promises of God. And a great fear because of that fact has fallen on us. You know, secondly, even though she lived among a pagan nation that probably believed in multiple gods, in verse 11, she says she believed that the God of the Israelites was the true God in heaven above and on earth below. I mean, what an incredible confession of faith from the lips of a woman whose life has been imprisoned in pagan idolatry. What great faith. And her faith led her to act. Have a look here in verse 12. This is what her faith enabled her to do. It says, now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. Our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us the land. I mean, it's amazing. Her faith enabled her to make this bold request to the spies and basically says to them, hey, look, when this city burns, when this city gets destroyed, I want you to swear to me. I want you to make an oath to me that you will be kind. You will show kindness to me and my family. And that you will save us from death. So I've shown kindness to you, show kindness to me. You know, it's amazing. Because she was convinced of judgment and destruction coming on the people around her, it completely changed her priorities. And she started getting consumed with thoughts like, who can I take with me? Who can I save along as well? Because I believe destruction will come. I believe those that are not part of God's people will be destroyed. Those thoughts started consuming her. But isn't that the same for you and I? When you are convinced that those that are separate from God and not reconciled with God, that when judgment day comes, they will not be with God, does that not change our priorities? Does that not start consuming us where we start thinking, who can I take with me? Who can I tell about this? Who can I reconcile with God? I mean, let me ask you this. Imagine we knew for a fact, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that next Sunday will be Judgment Day. That next Sunday we'll literally come to church, and after church, it will be done. It will be the end. How would that change the way that you live this coming week? Probably another question is, who would be some of the people that you'd be phoning up, begging and pleading for them to be reconciled with God? Because it changes things, right? It brings new perspective, that reality when we truly believe destruction is coming. Judgment will come. And that's what Rahab had right here. And it started consuming her to rescue her family and people connected to her family. She wanted to help them. And then in verse 14, after she makes this bold request to the spy says this, our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us the land. So they basically make the assurance to her saying, hey, because you've treated us kindly, because you've protected us, because you've taken this great risk, you know, when destruction comes, we tell you, our life for your life. We will take care of you. We will protect you. Now, we're not going to read sort of verse 15 down to 22. But what happens here is before the spies and Rahab sort of parts ways, in the story, the spies give her very specific instructions to make the oath that they made to her binding. And they basically say two things. The first one is, if you want the oath to be binding, you have to let a scarlet robe hang outside of your window. Now again, because we know sort of the geography of Jericho, you can understand that because her house was right up against that sort of lower level mud wall, her window was literally outside. So she could hang down this cord so that when the Israelites came, they would be able to see, oh wait, there's the house. There's the safe place. There's Rahab and her family. So that was the one. The other one that they mentioned is they said, hey, look, on the day of destruction, everybody that you once saved, you need to make sure that they're in that house, that they're inside. Anybody that's outside of that house, we cannot guarantee their life and their safety. So both of them, they stipulated sort of those instructions very clearly to her. They both agreed, and she led them out of the window, and they ran off to the hills, and later on joined the Israelite community. And then this is the report they gave to Joshua a little bit later on. It says, the Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us. So they report back to the Israelite community after spying out Jericho and the promised land. And they said, Joshua, buddy, we got some good news. This land is ours. People are quaking with fear because of the stories that they've heard about the God of Israel. Now let's see how the story ends. Have a look in Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. Now, I'm sure many of us are very familiar with the destruction of Jericho and what happened there. But it remains one of the most awe-inspiring events in history. Now, when you read it, you can't help but just think, man, God is intense. God is amazingly powerful. Joshua chapter 6, and we're just going to read a couple of passages here, verse 15. Now, before we get to verse 15, what happens here is God sends word to Joshua and said, hey, look, Jericho is not going to fall through a military campaign. How we're going to do this is I want you to gather all the people, and what I want you guys to do is I want you to march around the city for me. Do it for 6 days. You march once around the city, and on the seventh day, you march around 7 times. You'll have sort of a group of soldiers at the front, group of soldiers at the back, and right in the middle, you'll have the Ark of the Covenant and priests blowing horns. That's all I want you to do. And that fortified city with those great walls will fall. I mean, I don't know if you were an Israelite in that time and you heard that message when Joshua came to you and said, this is the plan. This is the massive military infiltration. This is a strategic campaign to infiltrate the promised land. I'm sure they would have stood there and said, yeah, you know, I don't know, man. That sounds a bit fishy. Now we'll pick up here in verse 15. It says, on the seventh day, so they start marching. On the seventh day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except that on that day they circled the city 7 times. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. I look down in verse 20. It says, when the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the people gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So every man charged straight in, and they took the city. Verse 22. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the prostitute's house and bring out all that who belong to her in accordance with the oath you've made to her. So young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother, brothers, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel.
Then they burned the whole city and everything in it, but they put the silver and the gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she had hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. I mean, it's kind of an amazing story here. What happens, they obviously march around the city seven times on the seventh day and gave a loud shout and the trumpets blast. I mean, it was this incredible event and the walls come tumbling down. Now, what they found through excavations at Jericho is they've actually found evidence for this exact biblical account, that the walls actually did crash and that they did tumble down and that the city was burnt. So they found that. And then the other amazing discovery that they found throughout their digging ups in the 1930s, 50s, and even in recent times is that there was a piece of the wall that did not collapse. All of the wall fell down, but on the northern side of the city, they cannot explain it, there's this little segment of wall that remained intact. Now, whose wall do you think that was? It was Rahab's. I mean, it's amazing to see how God was working. It's amazing if you start contemplating the purposes of God and how it turned out for Rahab and her whole family. Yeah, she and her whole family were spared. And, you know, eventually she got adopted into the Israelite community and became part of God's holy people. She married an Israelite man, had a son, Boaz, was the great-grandmother of David, and ultimately, in human terms, was in the line of Jesus Christ himself. Now, when you stand back and kind of consider this Hebrew narrative, when you consider this story, what are some of the things that I believe, what do you think we should take from it? Here are some of the things that I believe we should take from it. Number one, I think it's a story of hope. Yeah, it's a story of how God saved and transformed the life of Rahab. It's a story of second chances. I mean, you see her. You see her on the one hand, the before picture, she is a pagan prostitute, outside of God's people, living in promiscuity and impurity and immorality, living that life of isolation, being separate from God. And then God radically transformed and changed her, that she gets adopted into the community of God. And then she marries an Israelite man and be in the genealogy of Jesus Christ himself. It's a story of radical transformation. It's a story of God's incredible mercy and grace and his endless desire to save all men. You know, when the Jews would have read this story, probably the thing that would have come up for her is that here all of a sudden a pagan woman could become part of God's people. She was one of the early accounts. God communicated it through the Old Testament that it's not only the Jews. He wanted all men to become part of his family. He wanted to save all men. And it's a story of his incredible mercy and grace. But not only that, it's also a demonstration of God's incredible power. His power to transform anybody, regardless of your background, regardless of your current reality. God can save and transform lives. God can save the unsavable. Here's a little axiom that I believe as I look at this story, that just, I believe this story just shouts it, that if God could change Rahab, he could change anybody. If God could change Rahab, he could change anybody. You know, I've been a disciple now for 11 years. I was baptized when I was 20 years old. I was met on UCT at a university campus here by someone. I studied the Bible in 2 months and became a disciple. I remember as a young Christian believing that anybody, anywhere, at any time can be changed by God. I remember walking on campus thinking, if I could just invite this guy, if I could just invite this guy, if I could just speak to my classmate, they'll get it. All I need to do is, we just need to sit down and I just need to open up the Word of God. I just need to show them the Bible and boom, they'll make a decision to be a disciple. Well, I thought, I just need to bring them out of church. I just need to get them to meet some of you. They'll be instantly transformed. I walked around with that faith. I walked around with that surety that, man, if God could change me, He could change anybody. Yeah, 11 years down the line, I've realized for myself, as the years are rolled by, I've gotten very cynical. I've gotten very calculated in my faith. Where all of a sudden I look at people that are even inside of the family of God, being stuck in certain sin, I can look at them and go, I'm not sure they can change. Or people that we're helping through the scriptures, sometimes there would be doubts in my heart and my mind thinking, maybe they're beyond it. Maybe God can't do this. I've gotten very cynical in my faith, but yet if I read this story, the reality is if God could change Rahab, He'd change anybody. Maybe this morning you're studying the Bible and you feel like, man, I don't know if I have what it takes. Let me tell you, if God could change Rahab, He could change anybody. Maybe you're studying the Bible with someone and you feel like, dude, we've been around this block. We've had this conversation. I don't know. If God could change Rahab, He could change anybody. He could change those that are outside of the family of God. He could change those inside the family of God. God can change anybody because He could change Rahab. I believe it's a story of hope, a story of second chances, a story that should inspire our faith in the God that you and I serve. I believe another big lesson, if we stand back and consider the story of Rahab, is that it's a story of her great faith. If we look at her, and when the New Testament writers look back at Rahab's life in Hebrews chapter 11 and James chapter 2, the story of Rahab the prostitute is always recounted as a story of great faith. That she had incredible faith in God. And that sometimes we can find faith in unlikely places. And that her faith was a saving faith that got her to act and make decisions. Her faith was a great faith that enabled her to cash in her chips with God and His people and enabled her to overcome the world around her. That's the type of faith that she had. Her faith enabled her to look forward, to consider what will happen in the future, and that consideration affected how she lived today and the decisions that she made, the decisions to protect the spies. It's because of her faith. And ultimately, her faith saved her family. And people around her, and changed the whole course and direction of the generations to come from her onwards. Not only her immediate family, but the generations that will come after her was affected because of her great faith. Man, that's inspiring to me. As we close out here, my hope and prayer for us this morning is that you will leave full of hope and full of faith. That as you study out the story for yourself, as you think through Rahab and her life, my hope is that you will feel sort of something inside of you where you will leave with hope because of the God that you and I serve. And that we will look at her life and be inspired to grow, to have great faith as she had. And my prayer, my hope is that many years from now, when people recount your story and they look back at your life, when your grandkids talk about you, they would speak about you as we speak about Rahab. That your life is evidence that God has radically transformed you, not just once, but on a daily basis because of the God that you serve. And also as they talk about your life, that they will be inspired by the great faith that you and I have. And that faith will literally affect the generations to come from our time forward. I pray that you feel inspired this morning and that you can leave with great hope and great faith. Why don't we pray together?